My name is Katie Otto, and the interview you are about to hear is from April 17th, 2019, with Carol Adams. It's part of the Voices series. I decided to interview white women ages 65 and older about their experiences in the civil rights movement, to capture their stories, learn lessons from them, and hear their thoughts about what best practices might be for those of us who want to engage in anti-racist organizing going forward. Please enjoy.
Okay, I think we're all set here, and thank you so much. I am interviewing Carol Adams, who is a personal hero of mine and an author and an activist, and for the Voices Project around anti-racist and civil rights organizing. So thank you so much for taking time to talk.
My pleasure, yes. Katie, and what an exciting project.
Thank you. So I think the first thing I wanted to ask was, how did you first get involved in civil rights or anti-racist work, and what did that look like for you?
So I need to talk about my mother and where we were growing up. We grew up in Western New York, west of Buffalo, and my mother was a transplanted Minnesotan. So she had grown up with a woman who was orphaned young and very conservative. Her mother had been, you know, really sexually harassed when she worked for a farmer. She talked about being chased around his kitchen table in like 1910. My mother was born in 1914. Her father was a Norwegian immigrant. And so she, when she came with my father after they married and settled near where he had grown up in Western New York, I think she experienced difference. And she then fought for a new elementary school building in our town, and many people were upset because it was going to cost them on taxes. And she found she wasn't really welcome anymore with the PTA. And so in the 50s, she started looking, at first she volunteered with the Easter Seals. But by the early 60s, a couple things happened. One, my sister was learning Spanish, came back from Ecuador, was looking to do something locally, and she linked up with the migrant committee that was in our county, and went and would sing and meet with the migrant workers. So our county in 1960 had two kinds of migrant workers. They had migrant workers from Puerto Rico. Each farmer would kind of identify a town in Puerto Rico and fly there and hire the men, and the men would come in March or April, and they'd work till October, and then they'd be flown home. And then there were the contract laborers who came with crew bosses from the South. African-Americans, and the crew boss would have the contract and then pay or not pay the people on the bus. And my mother started hearing from my sister and realizing that the camps where these men stayed from Puerto Rico were not meeting health department requirements. So she started going to the camps. She joined the migrant committee, and she and another man, a physics professor — I know this is a long story, but it's just, I just have to lay this groundwork for how I became so acutely aware of it all. She and this professor would go to the migrant camps, you know, and they would check it out before the men would arrive, and they'd find these terrible conditions. And one time they found they were going to be put up in an old chicken coop. And so she and he and a few other people went and cleaned it. And I was drafted to clean it as well, and drafted to do other things. And then with African-Americans coming from the South, you know, this was the last of the Great Migration. Many of them resettled. They decided they didn't want to go back to the South, where, you know, Jim Crow was still so strong. And they resettled, and Mom got to know many of them. Many of the women became friends with them. And, you know, whatever sort of outcast sense she had as not being welcome in the village that she lived in because of her fight 10 years ago for this elementary school, she created a new community. And the new community was with the African-American women especially. And then some of the Puerto Rican men didn't go home, but they brought their family with them, and she became good friends with some of those women too. And so our house was always filled in the kitchen with mom and the women laughing and talking and strategizing. And she helped to create a program so that people could buy their own homes. It was called CASH, Citizens Action for Self-Help. And so one day, one of the children, a baby, had died in an African-American family that she was close to. And she went to the funeral. Of course, all the funeral directors were white. And she went to this funeral, and there was the baby, you know, with an open casket. And he was stuffed into a casket that was too small for him. And the funeral director, his eyes kind of bugged out when he saw my mother coming up the stairs, because he didn't expect any white people there. And when she saw what he had done, she was outraged. She was, you know, my father was a very prominent lawyer at this time. And she came home and she talked about it, and she was so angry. And I just remember that, you know, between the camaraderie that I just took for granted, you know, the interracial camaraderie of mom with the women, and then this terrible story of the cruelty and sort of banality of evil, really, of this funeral director, and realizing, you know, we're seeing the civil rights challenges in the South, but right here, you know, I'm 13 maybe, right here in Chautauqua County, we've got these problems. So even when I was in high school, I remember in the U.S. history, 11th grade, suddenly the boy who sat across from me, he just stood up and he turned to me and he said to the teacher, "What right does her mother have coming onto our property to see what we're doing?" You know, he was a farmer's son. "And she has no right to tell us what to do with our migrant workers." And I was sort of shocked, you know, like,
my gosh,
was sort of. And so, you know, I just said, "Well, if your father took care of his migrant workers, my mother wouldn't be doing this." You
yep.
know, so it's kind of back to you. I mean, I remember going with her once, and he was outside as we drove by. This must have happened a couple weeks earlier. So he had seen me see him and knew that I was going to the part of the farm that were the migrant camps. And so I just think it sizzled and then and burst out there. So I guess, and my father, he challenged the jury makeup in our town, in our county, for that the jury roles were not fair because they were mainly whites, and that blacks weren't represented well on the jury rolls. And I remember him coming home and talking about that. So all of that fed into who I was becoming acutely. And then I was in college, challenging the Vietnam War, protesting the Vietnam War, 1970, the feminist movement really comes to greater, you know, just is, it's not that it's born, but it just reaches a new level with Kate Millett's Sexual Politics, and I can send you the link. I wrote about that in the New York Times and other books. And I got involved with the feminist movement. I mean, I'd been raised feminist, but this was the first explicit getting involved. And then I went to New Haven, Yale Divinity School, and took a course on organizing in the urban setting, and took a course on Black liberation theology.
Black liberation. Have you done that?
Yeah, Black liberation theology. Really, well, there's a whole track of liberation theology that was tied with Latin American thought and a book called Pedagogy of the Oppressed, Freire, about how
I know it well.
And so this was when seminaries were really dealing with all that. So I took a course on liberation theology and a course on Black liberation theology. And so we were reading all of the works as they're coming out. And the community organizing I did then was with the New Haven Women's Liberation Center, which actually had a New Haven Women's Liberation band. I don't know if you've ever known about them. Just an aside, I've got their album. So that's from the
mid-70s. Oh, wow.
And then I worked in an abortion clinic. This is before Roe v. Wade, but in Connecticut, you could get an abortion if two doctors signed a form. And Yale New Haven was providing that service. So in the morning, the doctors would meet with the women who were going to have abortions, and they would sign the form. And in the afternoon, they'd have a meeting, and that's where I was involved, where we would help teach about birth control and what the abortion would be like. And then at 5 p.m., the doctors would come back from their offices, and they would perform the abortions. And we would accompany them. There were two other women, feminists from Yale Divinity School, who did this. And that's where I was when Roe v. Wade was decided, in the abortion clinic. And then I went to Philadelphia, and I was a feminist intern at the Christian Association, which used to own a building at 3601 Locust, I think it was. The Christian Association building. So we did organizing against rape. This is 73. A rape crisis center had been started, a rape hotline. And then in 74 to 76, I lived in Cambridge, and I worked with the first really homeless shelter for women. And it took no federal money, Rosie's Place it was called. And at first it was in an old butcher shop, if you can believe it. And then it got another home. And this is when, you know, domestic violence is being written about. Anyway, to live in Cambridge in the mid-1970s was incredible because there was so much feminist fervor and so much liberation fervor. And I hope you know about I'm going to blank on it because I'm trying to speak quickly. I know you only have a few minutes. The Combahee River Collective, do you know about them?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm in Cambridge when they start meeting. You know, we're all meeting at the Cambridge Women's Center. I'm not at their meetings or anything, but I read their first statement about the women who were being, the black women who were disappearing, and why wasn't anybody doing anything about it. So, you know, when I think about second wave feminism, I don't see it as a white feminism. I really see it as being so informed by liberation theology and Freire, and then the feminists like Barbara Smith and her sister and the others who were doing the Combahee River Collective. And I'm sure you've seen it, How We Get Free, the new book of oral interviews with them.
I haven't seen that. I would love to. I did get to learn about Combahee River Collective when I was in college, and it meant quite a lot to me. And
How We Got Free is a book that just came out last year, and it's interviews with them about how they started it and all. It's incredible. It just took me right back to Cambridge. And so then I was living in Cambridge but commuting to Yale and doing a course on theology and social change in the urban setting from a feminist perspective, and basically reading anything I wanted. I mean, just devouring everything. And then I went back to the rural area where I grew up. I was kind of confused and not knowing what I wanted to do. I got a Rotary Fellowship to go to Australia for a year of graduate school, but I had, in the summer intervening, my mother had continued to work with this migrant committee, which she had helped re-found as the rural ministry, Chautauqua County Rural Ministry. And I had been awarded the fellowship, but their director had just resigned, so I took the job for the summer. And this involved me with all the women I'd grown up with. It was so wonderful, you know, helping them.
Amazing.
Many of them own their own houses now, but they had other problems. And you know, my mother had been involved in helping one woman who was a domestic violence victim. She'd helped teach some of the women to drive and all. So suddenly I'm doing that for a summer. And during that same time, a new minister becomes, the president. And he says, well, we should meet weekly. So my mother and I fix his, you know, vegetarian food, and he comes over and He's young. He's from Union Theological Seminary. And we fell in love. And they hadn't found a director yet. And so I wasn't leaving until January. So I stayed on as director and continued to, you know, I was helping people apply for loans and grants. Some would be eligible for grants to weatherize their houses. My mother had succeeded in helping them get houses, but for instance, many of the black contract laborers from the South, they had worked for a canning factory. And the canning factory had given them land in a flood zone right on Lake Erie, where the Cattaraugus River meets Lake Erie. And if you went into their homes, they had pegs up high to hang all their chairs and everything because it flooded so much. So we were trying to help them get loans to raise their houses. And and then I'd also fallen in love. And but I wasn't going to give up my fellowship for a man because I was a feminist. And so I flew to California on my way to Australia. My ticket said, you know, San Francisco, Hawaii, Fiji Island, Sydney. And I had this incredible dream. I was with this feminist vegetarian who'd read my first essay on the theory of feminism and vegetarianism that had been published in 1975 in the Lesbian Reader. And she'd written me my first fan letter. So I'm with her and I fall asleep. I have a dream in which I dream I'm in a, you know, a cafeteria and a man keeps handing me a hamburger, a cheeseburger. And I say, no, I don't want a cheeseburger. At that point, I was saying I wanted a burger bun with cheese. And he kept handing me the hamburger. And I woke up and I was crying. And this woman goes on, Chellis goes on to become one of the first eco-psychologists, Chellis Glendening. I can send you her spelling, but she goes on to kind of pioneer a whole field of eco-psychology. But the thing she says to me is, what are you giving yourself you don't want? You know, that's the message of the dream. You're waking up crying from a dream where you're being handed something. What is it? And so I realized it was the trip. So I gave up. I handed in the ticket and got a ticket, a one-way ticket to Buffalo. And the American person in the office in San Francisco, back when they had offices, said, do you know what you're doing? And I said, yes, you know, because I wanted, suddenly I didn't want to be in school. It wasn't just that I loved Bruce, but I loved the work. And I was working with my mother, and it was so exciting. And so I flew back, and they were supposed to have offered the job to someone the day I decided. And they had a snowstorm because I called Bruce. I made the decision as I was going over the Golden Gate Bridge, and I called Bruce and said, Bruce, did you offer the job? And he said, because of a blizzard. So I could still be director of the rural ministry. So I flew back and I went and visited, you know, some of the women were with my mother, and they said, well, we prayed you back, Carol. And yeah, I've never told anybody that because it sounds so, I don't know, but they said, we prayed you back.
Yeah.
And so I formed a committee to advise me of local residents. And there's an area in Dunkirk, New York, that was heavily minority lived in, and lots of rental properties that weren't kept up and all. And that's what I wrote about in what came before the Sexual Politics of Meat. And I said to them, you know, maybe this is a month, I've only been back maybe 2 or 3 weeks, but I want, you know, to do what's, I want to be responsive to the community. What's the problem? What do I need to be looking at? And they said housing. And that's what led to the battle from 78 through 87. Around racism and housing. So I'm sorry, Katie, that's a long answer.
No, it's a great answer. Well, I do have a few other ones I wanted to ask quickly. What were some of the hard aspects of being involved in this work? You've outlined some, but what were some of the challenges?
Well, you know, I think I was a very naive person, and I expected people to like me. So two things happened. and I expected that people would listen to me. And two things happened. One is whites hated me. I mean, they hated me. They talked about me. It would be like being on Rush Limbaugh now, but it was a little inky-dinky radio station. My God, they could not stop talking. Why had I kept my own name? Had I kept my own name because I married a black? Because the only Buchanans in town were black? How many illegitimate kids I had?
Oh, my God.
At this point, my father was a judge. And what I realized is, you know, white privilege only goes so far. Once you've kind of aligned yourself, whatever white privilege you thought you had, I mean, I still had, I mean, I'm not saying I lost all my white privilege, but in that context, there was nothing to my whiteness that mattered except that they had to find a different reason for my unusual behavior and my failure to be loyal to whites. And so they sexualized me, you know, essentially. And the second thing was, we tried to show them your property taxes aren't going down. You know, I did all the research I had for Fredonia State, interns working with me nonstop to try to show, and I was working with the NAACP, so it's not like I was out there by myself. I was a member of the NAACP, and they made me chair of the housing committee, but we all worked together. We all tried to educate. But they wouldn't even listen. They wouldn't listen to any of us, that their property values weren't going to go down. And so, you know, in the end, we sue the city, we sue the housing authority, and we sue HUD, and then we also file a complaint against the radio station for racism.
Oh, wow.
So I know this, I mean, I don't know how much information you need. There's some more to tell, but I think you said you had to end at 4. So
I did want to ask just a few more questions. What were the most rewarding aspects of the work?
Well, I mean, I think I wanted to say one other thing. I felt real despair. It would enter my dreams. You know, Bruce didn't want me to put that in the article, but I would dream being raped by, you know, the head of the radio station.
Oh, God.
And
yeah.
There was a lot of sexual violence dreams because I had also at the same time started a hotline for battered women. And the hotline, we tried to get other people to help us, you know, and volunteer, but then that's too long a story. But it had ended up that we put it in the church manse after we got back from our honeymoon. So, you know, I'm kind of answering, Bruce and I are the only ones answering this hotline. Covering this hotline at the same time. So, you know, it's not a surprise
and
that I'd have
Bruce
dreams.
Bruce, your partner, yeah.
Yeah, that would combine sexual violence and racism because, you know, these were my two fronts, as it were, that I'm trying to fight at the same time. I mean, I never anticipated the challenges of fighting for housing. I mean, and that whole thing starts because of the collapse of, or the, you know, this, they're trying to say, you know, do you want your daughter raped by a black man? And, you know, to keep the housing out of the neighborhood where it was supposed to go. So, you know, we know that all the myths about sexual violence and black men and how it was used in lynching and, you know, so the whole thing was wrenching. And they threw eggs at our house, and then the anti-housing people, they made the person who lived across from us the president so that they could meet there every week and, you know, try to intimidate us. And I remember
this is all awful.
We had black plaintiffs, and there were three groups of plaintiffs. Black plaintiffs who were deprived of good housing because HUD had failed to enforce their housing loans. Black plaintiffs who had housing but were not getting loans, and, you know, and white plaintiffs who were being deprived of the right to live in an integrated community. That's part of the Fair Housing Act of 68.
Yep.
And one of the plaintiffs was this woman. She had children, and her mother was a plaintiff, too. It was very brave, but she had lupus. And I remember, you know, the day she died, I biked down to be with the mother, and when I biked back, all along the street that we lived were the anti-housing cars because they were having a meeting. And I just, like, the inhumanity of it was, what's the matter with you that you can't see humanity?
Horrible.
You know, that was all very complex. But theologically, there's this thing about Tillich. You know, Tillich talks about the courage to be. That, and I interpreted that as all you have to be is courageous for today. All I had to do was care enough to make the first step. And even though, you know, down the road I get attacked and all of us got attacked, but there was a specific fetishizing of me as a white woman, I feel, that all I needed was the courage to take the first step. And by taking the first step, I got stronger. And then I could take another step. And even though people started, you know, there was all this, you know, attacking, but then I was a stronger person than when I first started and was so naive. So part of it was I grew into being a warrior. I mean, I had been a warrior, but I grew the carapace or whatever that's needed for a warrior. And that really came in handy when 80% of the reviewers hated Sexual Politics of Meat. And you know, I was talked about by Rush Limbaugh. You know, he didn't know where I lived.
So, well, that sounds like that's kind of the question I had about the biggest lesson you had to learn that time. So you sort of have spoken to that. And I have to run in a second here, but I think you've spoken to the biggest lesson. But I guess my final question would just be, and I do have to run, but I would love to hear a bit of advice that you would give young people today and young white women in particular who want to engage in anti-racist work.
Well, know your community. I mean, you're in a community. Figure out what your community's issues are. Read about white privilege. Read about, you know, it's got to be a combination of always learning, because we can never assume we figured out how much white privilege we have, because there's always something lurking that we don't even realize was our white privilege. And you really want to kind of be aware enough that you're not walking in with white privilege as your carapace. You really want to go in to do this work with awareness. And, you know, we talk about allies, but an allyship is born out of respect and being part of a community. I mean, all of this came about because I said to the community, what's the issue? I didn't go in and say, here's what I think the issue is.
I think that's so critical.
It's what's the issue, and what can I bring to this? You know, what are my gifts that I can share here?
Yeah.
But don't presume that you can answer the question, what's the issue and what's the problem?
Yeah.
I mean, with Black Lives Matter, we know what the issue is. So you know, turning out for Black Lives Matter marches, you know, all of that. Always challenging racism among your friends, calling it out, you know, so that, I mean, one of the biggest challenges for us is educating white people. That's a unique thing that we white women can be doing. White women can be very dangerous.
I agree. That's the kind I want to be in the world. That's the sort of the motivation behind this project. But thank you so much for taking time. And I'm sorry I have to run now, but I would love maybe we can even have a follow-up conversation, because this was really, really rich. I think I really appreciate you, Carol. Thank you so much.
Okay, Katie. I know you're in between so many things. I'll just say finally, through the rural ministry, I got to work with my mother.
That's amazing. And that's why I was inspired to do this project. So.
Oh, that's neat. That's neat.
There's a lot of strength there, too.
Well, I hope we can catch up a little more just in general sometime. But thanks for this project. And let me know, you know, if you want to follow up.
Okay. Thank you so much, Carol.
Thanks for listening.
Yep. Thank you for sharing. Bye.